Blog Talk Radio.
Brock Lesnar and Alistair Overeem, I'm ready to stop watching this. So help me God, for those of you who are fans of GSP or Anderson Silva, better pray I don't become a huge fan of theirs, because they will stub their toe on the way out to the match and then fall down and break their leg and they'll never be able to fight again. Or they will go on a losing streak that is just phenomenal. Hello, and welcome to the 411 Ground and Pound radio show. I am, of course, Mark Radulich, here to bring you all the insights and excitement in the world of MMA. If you would like to give us a call, the number is 323-657-0901. That's 323-657-0901 to call in with your questions, comments, and other picture postcards. So last night was the Strikeforce Henderson, Fedor versus Henderson. And what a night it was. I'm going to bring out the panel right now, because we have a lot to talk about, not just with last night's fight, but also even deeper than the fights themselves. You have a burgeoning political situation with the recent cut of Alistair Overeem and Sergey Karadenov, who hasn't been cut yet, but is both of which have been selected to compete in October's United Glory new round of World Series. So, a lot to talk about here concerning Strikeforce and the future of the heavyweight division they're in. So I want to bring out the 411 expert panel. First, from the three R's, he's Dan Henderson's biggest fan, and rightly so after last night, Jeffrey Harris.
Hello?
That's your cue, sir.
Okay, well, once again, it is the J to the E to the double F. Woo! And it is great to be back from vacation, back from San Diego Comic-Con. I know you all probably missed me last week, but the worries, the concerns are over as I am back, baby. And I have once again proven that I am the greatest writer in the history of sports and MMA. I call it Dan Henderson, the greatest of all time. The best in the world, beats everyone's favorite, Fyodor Emelianenko, who is now only 3-3 in MMA. His real record is now 3-3, gentlemen, after losing Dan Henderson.
Okay, welcome back, Jeff. Yes, if you listened to last week's show, Scott and I spent most of the hour talking about how much we missed you. And speaking of Scott, here he is, another member of the expert panel, Scott Kachowski. How you doing, Scott?
How you doing, Mark? I'm sorry I don't have as exciting of an introduction as Jeffrey does.
If you did, it would take up the entire show, so I'm kind of glad you don't. And welcoming back to the show after a two-week hiatus, Sam Riccati. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, guys. I missed you all. Well, except for Jeff, but I miss most of you.
Same, or it'd be very sad because I did miss you.
No, I do miss you, Jeff, honestly.
Okay,
right,
thank
you. Glad to be back.
I know behind the scenes there's a whole discussion regarding just how great Dan Henderson is, and we will get to it momentarily. But I do want to get right into last night's main event, Fedor versus Henderson, and the big question on everybody's mind, and I'm going to pitch this right to Cooch because you were the first person to comment on it in the report. There's a debate forming of whether or not the stoppage was early. Of course, Dan Henderson won last night's fight by technical knockout. It looked like Fedor was laying into him. He escapes through the back door, kind of switched himself around Fedor, punched out Fedor. Fedor went flat. Then he hit him two more times. People saying it was in the back of the head. Those were illegal shots, and he should have been pointed. But what actually happened was, was once Fedor actually went down, Herb Dean made his way over there to stop the fight, and that was the end of that. And people saying, well, nope, too early. So, Scott, why don't you weigh in on this? Why don't you give your opinion on whether or not the stoppage was legit or early?
Well, Dan Henderson hit that switch, and it was beautiful. And the uppercut that he threw, Fedor never even saw coming. You know, he was behind Fedor. Through that uppercut, I believe it came up underneath his right arm, and that really just, it put Fedor flat down on his face. And at that point, he was out. Dan delivered a couple extra shots only because he knew it was Fedor. Herb Dean, though, was, for the fraction of a second that Fedor was out and he was face down in the canvas, Herb Dean deserves all the recognition in the world for recognizing that he was at that point out cold. Ran in, made the stoppage, you know, and I thought it was awesome. I thought it was perfect, and that right there is exactly how fights should be stopped. You shouldn't see a guy get woken up from unconsciousness only to get knocked out again by punches. You don't want to see that. And Herb was great. He deserves all the credit in the world for that stoppage because, you know, a lot of guys, I think, as fans, we're guilty of this. You know, and you can see it on all the message boards, and I'm sure you've seen it on, you know, the comments from your on 411 from your play-by-play, is that people walk in, you know, they're watching this fight and there's emotion involved, and, you know, they're fans of Fedor and they're fans of Henderson, and you know, nobody wants to see one of their favorite fighters or somebody that they consider a legend get beaten that way. And so there's always the thought of, well, they should have let it go longer. They should have given him a chance. He looked like he was recovering. He looked like he was coming out of it, you know. So it should have been more definitive. But, you know, that's – you've got to take your emotion out of it. And I think that's something that a lot of the refs are getting good at. They are, you know, leaving their emotions out, and they're recognizing, okay, this guy's out. And once that guy's out, that fight's over. Right. It doesn't matter whether he wakes up with the next punch or not, and I think it was a great stoppage.
Jeff, I want you to weigh in on this, and I have a specific question for you, because people are comparing this to the Pat Barry Czech Congo fight, and they're also comparing it to Lesnar and Carwin. Actually, they're actually comparing it to both Lesnar and Carwin, Lesnar and Velasquez, where it looked like the ref was giving both guys in both situations plenty of time to recover, and when they couldn't do it, you know, especially in the case of Lesnar and Velasquez, that's when they stopped it. You know, in other words, they erred on the side of giving them the time. Do you believe that this was a situation where they should have given Fedor the opportunity to fight back, or do you agree with those who are saying no, he was out, there's nothing to come back from?
He's out. The dude face planted. He fell flat on his face, on his belly. That did not happen in any of those aforementioned fights. Look at what happened to Dan Henderson. Dan got rocked. He kind of went down. He recovered. He postured up. He got into a defensive position. Fedor, he face planted. He fell flat on his face, on his belly. The man was out. Yeah, he turned over, but he was still in a prone, vulnerable position where his head was wide open, and he still would have gotten pummeled. And Fedor and protect Fedor. A fighter will never complain a fight was stopped too late. A true fighter will never do that. That's just how it is. Now, Fedor nut huggers and Fedor fans, of course they believed it was stopped early. Nogueira nut huggers believed the fight with Frank Mir was stopped too early and believed that Nogueira was going to survive and just was going to be okay. But look at Nogueira after that fight was stopped against Frank Mir. He was wobbly. He could barely get to his feet. It was the same thing with Fedor last night. Dan Henderson beat him. Dan Henderson knocked out Fedor. Dan Henderson is the greatest of all time. Love it, learn it, live it.
So, Samer, that being said, with Dan Henderson being the greatest of all time, you definitely know where Jeff is coming from. What was that, Samer?
Oh, I just said so much for taking emotion out of it.
Yeah, there's no emotion here, none whatsoever. So what is, you know, if you listen to the interviews after the fight last night, Fedor, a little bit different tone than when he got his face caved in by Bigfoot. And now he's saying, yeah, he's actually saying that, you know, he thinks the fight was stopped too early. He thinks, you know, he could have gone on. But he's not as committed to retiring this time, you know, but he's back to it's God's will, which is fine. He spoke more about, you know, he's not angry that he lost the fight. He just wants to go home and hold his kid, and I can certainly sympathize with that. But, you know, what do you do with Fedor at this point? What do, you know, if you're M1 and you're not, you know, willing to feed him to the grinder for an extra $1 million, you're actually looking out for his benefit. What do you do after three consecutive losses where each one of them, you know, the first time maybe it's a fluke, the second time you're beaten by a giant, the third time you're beaten by a guy who usually fights two weight classes underneath you. Where does Fedor go from here?
What are you talking about? He lost apparently to the greatest of all time. You just take it on the chin and move on. Obviously, you know, when you lose to Dan Henderson, he's the greatest of all time on Jeffrey Harris's list, so there's no shame in that. In all seriousness, there's actually no shame in that loss. I mean, it's not like Fedor looked horrible or anything. And, you know, as Scott mentioned, I thought the stoppage, not the referee stoppage, but what Henderson did to stop Fedor was just fantastic. I mean, this wasn't like the Bigfoot fight where he looked old and slow, you know, all credit to Dan Henderson because hitting that switch and then just killing him with one uppercut, that was quite fantastic. You know, if Fedor thinks it, you know, leaves it in the hands of God, well, I'll never leave it in the hands of...
Did we lose you, Samer?
No, Samer. I'm still here.
Okay, great. Go ahead. Yeah, never leave it in the hands of God. Go.
Right, yeah. But, you know, if he does leave it in the hand of God, you know, I'd say one more fight and would be appropriate just to judge where he actually is. Because at the end of the day, he wasn't losing to nobodies, whether it's Verdum or Bigfoot Silva or even Dan Henderson. You're right, he fights two weight classes below him. But at the end of the day, Dan Henderson is Dan Henderson. So I'd say one more fight for Fedor just to really gauge where he's at, you know, because if he retires now, who knows, maybe I'm pretty sure, you know, his days at the top are over, that's for sure. But I think the guy can still fight, you know.
I had a friend of mine.
He's totally washed.
I had a friend of mine say to me on Facebook earlier today, he's like, you know, no, so, you know, what comes up must inevitably come down, and you know, you certainly hate to see a fight like last, unless you're Jeff, you hate to see a fight go the way it did last night, you know, against Fedor. But he said, you know, but does a fight like last night take away from Fedor's overall legacy? And this is a question that we keep debating. We've now had to ask this two previous times. Did the Bigfoot fight take away from his legacy? Did the Wardroom fight take away from his legacy? And, you know, and I've made the argument in the past that, you know, a legacy is a legacy. Sometimes you stay a little too long, but... You know, and you don't recognize maybe when the sport has passed you, but I don't think that diminishes what you've already accomplished. I may be example of Tyson. You know, we all remember Tyson, especially if you're on my age, being the knockout artist that he was. But what do people remember Tyson for now? Fighting Holyfield's deer. And I certainly wouldn't want to see that happen to Fedor. But do you think that that's sort of the danger here? Is that he won't be the guy that went on the 10-year run? He'll be the guy that lost. You know, he'll be the Tito Ortiz of Russia.
You know, I'm totally with you in that it doesn't take away from his legacy, because at the end of the day, I think a fighter, gauging just how good a fighter is, you know, should be judged on how good he was in his prime. That's not to say that the guy is totally old and, you know, washed up, but it's clear that Fedor is not the fighter he used to be. And, you know, one loss, if we're talking about the Verdum loss, for example, one loss does not take away from a legacy. I mean, everybody loses eventually. The thing is, yeah, people are going to say that because people are just looking for any reason to discredit any fighter.
don't get me wrong, I never thought Fedor was as great as people said, and he was pretty great, and at one point he was the greatest, you know, whoever lived, but if you talk to some Fedor fans at the time, it was ridiculous that they believed he could beat, you know, three heavyweights at the same time. Like, honestly, at the height of his powers, Fedor fans were the most annoying fans out there. Like, really, it got ridiculous. So I'm not, like, you know, I'm not just trying, I'm not somebody who's bitter over Fedor falling from grace. You know, anybody who's watched any sport, especially individual sport, knows that nothing lasts forever. And at the end of the day, you know, right now we...
Samer? Hello, Samer? Guys?
Hello? Yep, go ahead.
Still here.
Yep, go ahead, finish.
Yeah, so, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, you keep talking.
Samer... Are you just so overwhelmed with emotion here that you just have to stop talking in the middle of your soliloquy?
No, but if you cut me off, I'm gonna have to stop talking. So I'd appreciate if I can talk. And anyway, after my thought, I'll hang up and call again just in case, you know, there's something wrong with the connection or whatever. Anyway, you know, right now we say Anderson Silva was the greatest of all time, but the guy is pushing 40 in a couple of years, and once he loses, and he will, and people are going to say that he was never as good as people used to say he is. So, you know, that's just a cycle of fighting. I don't think these losses take away from Fedor's legacy at all. I mean, you know, his legacy is his legacy.
Okay. Why don't you click off and then come back in while I go over to Scott.
Yep.
Scott,
We
know what's happening with Alistair Overeem, and just a brief synopsis for those who haven't been reading the story. I'm going to say this as fairly as I can. It looked like, if you go through the entire series of events, he went to Strikeforce and said, "Look, I've got nagging injuries. When are we doing this again? It would be better if we did it in October." And Strikeforce said, "Yes, October is fine." He then goes on vacation and comes back and says, "I'm going to fight in October, and so I'll start my camp, and I'll, you know, and hopefully I'll deal with these injuries the best that I can." After they've committed to October, they go to Showtime. Showtime says, "No, go in September. October, there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on, boxing-wise and whatever else, so your date's in September." They go back to Overeem and said, "Sorry, we promised you October. It's really September." And Overeem says, "To hell with you. You told me October. I planned for October. I'm not switching things now, especially in my injured state." At which point he's yanked from the tournament by Zuffa and replaced with Dan Cormier. Now, if the story had ended there, I don't even think I'd bring it up again. But then he goes and turns around, and here is where Alistair Overeem just loses me. He books himself, because last week Scott and I had talked about what should they do with Overeem in October. You know, why not make a new title fight until this tournament's over? No, instead he decides he's going to fight for United Glory. And then he's summarily fired. So, Scott, what do you make of the situation? And more to the point, and I actually thought last night they were going to surprise us and just make last night's match a title fight for the now vacant heavyweight title in Strikeforce and just throw it on whoever won that fight. I thought that would have been fun. We haven't heard anything, but they didn't do it. We haven't heard anything as far as this tournament crowning a new champion. We really don't know where this is headed. What do you make of the situation?
It's a mess. The whole thing's a mess. You know, Alistair Overeem, I don't know what his motivation is. You know, is he trying to get a better contract? Is he trying to get a new contract? Is he trying to restructure something? You know, all of that's a mystery. He, a few hours after he was released from his contract, he put up one of his video blogs, which showed him going to the hospital where, you know, they said he's got a broken rib and, you know, he's got these nagging injuries. And so I think that was like his little, you know, "Hey, let me explain, you know, why I'm not fighting, you know, and let me put it out on video so that, you know, everybody can kind of understand my side of it," which is fine, but... to, you know, flatly refuse to fight in September, you know, dig into his heels. And you know what? Hey, if you're injured, you know, and you really can't prepare for the fight in time, okay, then that's fine. Be an honest broker and just say, "Hey, you know, you guys said October. I'm saying, you know, but then you said September." You know, and I think that's something that most people can understand. Okay, you know what? If you're going to move up the fight, I'm probably not going to be ready for it. But then to turn around and say, And you know what? Now I'm going to go fight for this other promotion in October. You know, when you guys initially booked me, you know, that's going to be, that's, you know, everybody involved is going to view that as a slap in the face.
Right.
So, you know, and there's a funny thing that I think is going to come out of this, and I think you're going to start seeing this, especially from, you know, entities like Showtime that, you know, have this, you know, somewhat involvement in MMA. I think the open contracts, I think the non-exclusive contracts, I don't think you're going to see them all that often anymore. I think this is going to be a lesson learned from Showtime that the UFC, you know, as the biggest promotion with these exclusive contracts, that that's probably the right way to go. And it would not be, and it wouldn't surprise me if that's something Showtime is learning right now, because they're watching, you know, this Grand Prix fall apart. You know, and you mentioned with Hart Tonoff that, you know, the same thing can happen, because he is also, you know, if he wins his bout in September against Josh Barnett, in October he is also supposed to be fighting in Russia. And, you know, that's, it just becomes this massively awkward situation, because, you know, potentially he's going to go out and, you know, he might get released because Zuffa might not want him fighting in another tournament when he's still locked in for this, you know, Grand Prix. And it's just a crazy situation. And unfortunately, this is something Strikeforce should have seen when they started this whole when they started this Grand Prix. And I had mentioned that in one of my comments earlier, that had Strikeforce just said to everybody, including, you know, fans and the fighters, okay, you know, here are the dates for, you know, the Grand Prix events. You know, the initial bracket is going to be on this date, and then the next bracket is going to be on this date, and then the finale will be on this date. You know, and you really only have to come up with three or four dates, and you put them out there, then that way the fighters and the fans know when they're going to be fighting. And it's not rocket science, you know, but they didn't do that, and so now they've kind of got this situation where literally we could have the end of, you know, we could have Chad Griggs against Daniel Cormier in the finale, and what's that going to look like for the Strikeforce Heavyweight Grand Prix?
Didn't this happen many years ago in one of the first UFC tournaments where they, you know, I think Shamrock had to pull out, and then somebody else pulled out, and it ended up being two alternates in the final?
Yeah, and you had a winner of Steve Jenham, who won one fight or something like that. Yeah, it was, but, you know, and this is, and I think this is going to be a lesson learned. I think this is going to be a lesson learned for Showtime. I think it's going to be a lesson learned for a lot of the execs at Strikeforce, that, you know, if you don't have these guys locked into contracts where they can't go out and ply their services elsewhere, you're going to have problems like this. You're going to have guys who, you know, they're conflicted, you know, and it is a conflict of interest. I don't care what you say. When you have one of your star fighters is fighting for a rival promotion, that is a conflict of interest. How can you, you know, because, you know, we can sit there and say that, well, there's not really a true rival to the UFC, and that's true. But I could honestly see that there are true rivals to Strikeforce, because Strikeforce isn't at the UFC level. So if you are plying your trade, you know, at any other promotion outside of Strikeforce, you're potentially, you know, fighting for a rival. And
right.
I think that's bad business.
You know, here's the thing, and then I want to bring Jeff in, and then we're probably going to have to move on. With the, you know, but before Strikeforce got brought up by Zuffa, and they weren't, and it was unclear when they were going to have fights. I mean, they were really doing them like every other month, you know, sporadically. They had no clear vision as to what they were doing. They were booking by the seat of their pants, and I can understand signing guys like Alistair Overeem, who's a real journeyman and, you know, fights everywhere, saying, look, if you, you know, plus they also had a deal with Dream where they were trading fighters. So I can understand the open contracts, you know, when it was unclear how often guys were going to fight. Poor Cyborg Santos, you know, best example of this. However, once that got locked up by Zuffa, you're absolutely right. This is the end. If Strikeforce is going to remain a separate brand and continue its existence, it will do so as basically, you know, UFC light. And there will be no such things as open contracts. They will never do this again. But part of that is because they have a consistent schedule now. What, you know, how is it that Zuffa took this? I don't know. Sometimes I think Zuffa took over Strikeforce and then just said, okay, well, you know, here's some extra PR guys, run it, and didn't realize just how FUBAR they this company really is and how they have no degree of long-term planning. But, Jeff, final question on this, and then I do want to move on. What do you do with the belt at this point? What do you do with the belt?
You know,
how do you bring this to a nifty
conclusion? We're already on this. And we didn't talk about how Fedor really has a record of 3-3 and how Dan Henderson is the greatest of all time, how I predicted that fight properly. I predicted Dan Henderson, and I also put Dan Henderson as number one on my top 25 list, but we'll move on. First of all, Mark, it would have been ridiculous to make that fight a heavyweight title fight, considering Fedor was only 3-2 going in that fight and was coming off two straight losses.
Oh, given Strikeforce's history of doing odd title fights, it would not have been it only would have been ridiculous if you think logic has a place in Strikeforce. It would have been fantastic given their history, but please continue.
Look. It would have been ridiculous. Dan Henderson's not a heavyweight. He's a career middleweight and light heavyweight. Guy is not a heavyweight. Plus, you have a heavyweight tournament going on right now, and what a spit in the face that would be if you're going to strip the title off of Overeem and just suddenly give it to two guys, one who's not even a real heavyweight and one who hasn't even won a heavyweight fight since 2009. It makes no sense to me. Mark is making a lot of sense here. Strikeforce, I tournament was messed up from the beginning. This is ultimately what I saw happening. And the reason I saw it happening is because you had Fedor and M1 Global involved, you had Josh Barnett involved, and then you have Alistair Overeem involved. And listen, Overeem, he's clearly got potential. He's a big dude. He can clearly become popular with the fans. But most of his wins, his MMA wins, are in Japan against tomato cans. That's what he's been doing for most of his fights. He's been taking easy fights over in Japan or over in Holland. And I think it's really stupid if he really wants more money and bigger fights in MMA that he's does this stupid negotiating ploy of fighting in October. See, I would have been ready to fight in October if they just listened to me. It's pathetic. Don't do that. Don't do crap like that. Even if you're non-exclusive, it's my understanding from MMAJunkie.com that Alistair Overeem, that any opponent he has outside of Strikeforce needs to be approved by Zuffa. Scott Coker doesn't know how to run an MMA company. This is indicative of that. He promised that all these guys were locked in for contracts. Now, Sergey Karatanov has no excuses. Dude, you're in one of the MMA tournaments of all time. You're going to the semifinals. Why the frick do you want to talk about fighting in October? Dude, if you beat Josh Barnett, You have a shot at being one of the top ranked heavyweights in the world. Why are you fooling around like this, Sergey Karatanov? It's idiotic. Why is he looking at a fight in October when this is the biggest fight of his career? Why is he talking about a fight in October right after the biggest fight of his career? It's pathetic. You're in a tournament. You need to be thinking about the semifinals, and then after this, you got to think about winning the semifinals and then going to the finals. These guys don't have any idea. These guys have fought in Pride. These guys have been in tournaments before. Overeem has been in tournaments before where he got less than 2 months to prepare for a second round. This is ridiculous. You're in a tournament. You need to be thinking about the tournament mindset. These guys are really acting foolishly. Scott Coker does not know how to run a tournament or an MMA company. I put this on him. This was a disaster from the very beginning because, yeah, like Mark says, they didn't set up dates for all the rounds. They didn't have an idea of when they were – oh, yeah, they did, April, but then they delayed it to June. How much longer should they delay a tournament? The tournament's been delayed enough already. Let's see it get finished. Good on Daniel Cormier for stepping up.
Samer, one last thing on this.
Samer's back. Good. I thought he ran away.
No, he did not run away. He is back, and he has something to say.
Right.
the one last bit of business on this is not only do we have Overeem out, Kalanitov, Screwy, and now the latest on this is that Josh Barnett may not be able to get his license in Ohio. So I wanted to give you a chance just to, if you had any thoughts to add on this. I also want to ask you what you thought of the Miesha Tate, Marlus Konen fight last night. If you had any thoughts on how that went, it looked like Tate controlled Konen for. I had her up the first round and the third round, and I don't remember how well the fourth round went before she finally submitted her. I probably would have given her that one too. Looked like Tate really was able to use her wrestling to control Konen, and. You know, I definitely deserved the win there, but I wanted to know if you had any thoughts on, either the Barnett or the Tate-Konen fight.
Yeah, I'll start with your second question. I thought Miesha Tate looked quite spectacular, and really it's the biggest testament to what training in a great camp would do to you. She's training in an alpha male, which is very suitable for her because most of the guys there are her size. You know, if you're a female fighting in MMA, it's pretty hard to find quality training partners because, just to put it bluntly, there aren't that many quality female fighters out there, especially when you take into account weight classes. Look at Team Alpha Male, and you look at Uriah Faber and Joseph Benavidez and Chad Mendez. They're almost her size, so it's pretty easy to spar. You know, I once was lucky enough to go to Extreme Couture in Las Vegas, and Gina Carano was sparring with Tyson Griffin. And at first, I thought it was odd, but then it made sense because he's one of the few her size. And that's how you improve. And submitting Marlus Konen, like if you told me before the fight that somebody was going to submit the other, I would say, you know, it's pretty probable that it would have been Marlus Konen would submit Miesha Tate, and that's why I favored her since Tate as a wrestler. But she really improved her grappling dramatically. I mean, her top game looked fluid, you know, guard passing, ground and pound, and that arm triangle was pretty beautiful how she spun to the side. So she really impressed me. I mean, I obviously thought she had a chance, but I would have thought decision or something like that. I really didn't anticipate a submission.
One quick thing. I thought Konen had her in the second round with the rear naked, and she defended it the entire time, and it was like, you know, while it wasn't the most interesting thing in the world to watch, I gave Kate a lot of credit because, you know, as she said later on in the press conference, she was trying, and it wasn't a comfortable place for me to be in, but I was never in trouble, which is a real testament to her submission defense.
Absolutely, yeah. That was one of the things that struck me about the fight because, you know, so if she doesn't defend that hold, she doesn't get out of the second round, she loses the fight. So, you know, everything that happened afterwards was just a direct result of her being able to escape that submission, as obvious as this sounds. But it's pretty interesting remark there because, you know, submission defense is probably one of the hardest things to master, especially when you have a pretty good grappler on your back. Like fighters in general, you know, you talk to any fighter, that's when they panic the most, when somebody has their back. You know, even when you're mounted, if it's from the front, you can still hip escape. You can, you know, you can block the punches. There are less submission possibilities, or at least, you know, not less. There are actually more submission possibilities, but they're more difficult to pull off. Whereas, you know, if somebody has your back, how many times do we see a rear naked choke in an MMA fight? It's probably the most common submission hold out there. So to be able to keep your composure and defend when, you know, the guy or girl in this case on your back is pounding on you and, you know, control her wrist and even when she got that body triangle and flattened her out, yeah, that's actually a pretty, you know, accurate remark on your part. I totally agree. With regards to the second part was Sergei Karitonov and the whole Grand Prix thing. First of all,
the possibility of him not being able to get licensed in Ohio.
Right. Well, you know, for starters, just to go back on, to get back on a previous point, I think the winner of the tournament should be crowned the champion. I think it's an obvious thing to do, even though I don't think it matters because seeing how you know, the chaos that reigns Strikeforce right now, even by their standards, things are pretty chaotic. I don't anticipate them being around for much longer, or at least their top fighters, that is. That being said, yeah, you know, Jeff hit the nail on the head. But when you have Fedor and Overeem and Barnett in the tournament, you're asking for trouble. Though I don't really fault Strikeforce, because if they didn't have those guys, who would have cared about the tournament? Really, I mean, you know, you can say that maybe they could have done without Aster Overeem since he was the champion and it didn't make much sense for him to be in the tournament. But, you know, Fedor was one of the main attractions, and Josh Barnett, you know, say whatever you want about him. He's still a great fighter. I mean, if you take out those three guys, who do you replace them with? I mean, I love Daniel Cormier, but, you know, he's not, especially back at the time, he didn't have the big wins he has now. So it wouldn't have made much sense to
they could have had
know.
Bobby Lashley. Damn you, Samer. They could have had Bobby Lashley.
You stole
he's
my
waiting
joke.
In Kansas
I was
to fight.
Getting to that. I was getting to that, Mark. I honestly was getting to that. You stole my joke, but yeah. But,
sorry.
Like, seriously, with the shortage of heavyweights and quality heavyweights, it's ridiculous to have a Grand Prix and just fill them up with, you know, filler, basically. Just you know, for the
point
sake
is,
of having... I'm sorry?
My point is the tournament was a bad idea because look at it now. It's falling
apart. Yeah, I
agree.
I totally agree. And to that, I would also...
They shouldn't have done the tournament at all, Samer. That's what I'm
okay,
saying.
I think
agree,
that's what
Jeff,
Samer's
I'm
getting to, so
you.
Let Samer finish.
Yeah, please.
Go
I'm
ahead.
Actually agreeing with you. The tournament was, I wouldn't say a bad idea, but it was a little too ambitious from their part. You know, when we first, we had the first All the King's Men thing where we commented on the tournament, and everybody was, even the optimistic ones, had their skepticism regarding the tournament, because, yeah, there was so much that could go wrong, and it did, and I wouldn't say I'm glad it did, because obviously I'm not. I wanted to see the fights. But it teaches us something. And, you know, you read all these comments all the time. At the time when the tournament happened and everybody was proclaiming that it was the biggest thing to happen since sliced bread, everybody was like, oh, the UFC would never dare to do something like that. Well, why do you think that is? Because it's a stupid idea. Yeah, the UFC shouldn't dare to do something like that, because if one fighter pulls out, just one fighter, you know, it can screw everything up. Like, let alone two or three, which is what, apparently now everything is falling apart. We won't have a tournament anymore. And, you know, that's one thing. People always criticize the UFC for not putting on tournaments. Well, yeah, that is why. And at the end of the day, things work out in a tournament format anyway, even if it's not official. And the best example I can give, I don't want to take too long, but the best example I can give is, back in the past 2 years, the UFC actually had a heavyweight tournament. It's just that nobody realizes it. Brock Lesnar fought Shane Carwin. Cain Velasquez fought Minotauro Nogueira. That's one bracket. And on the other bracket, you had Roy Nelson fighting Stefan Struve and Junior Dos Santos fighting Gabriel Gonzaga. You know, Dos Santos won. He advanced. He faced Nelson. Velasquez faced Lesnar, who beat Carwin. And now Velasquez is going to face Dos Santos in the final. It's actually a heavyweight Grand Prix. I'm pretty sure Joe Silva didn't have it all in mind and plan it that way. But things have a way of unfolding. If the UFC actually had proclaimed this to be, you know, the official heavyweight tournament, people would have went nuts with excitement just because you put a label on it. But at the end of the day, it's no different. One more final point, and this, I'm also happy this happened, because the other reason people criticize the UFC all the time, and, you know, I'm not a blind UFC defender. In fact, I always attack Dana White on this very show, but they know what they're doing. Another reason why people always attack the UFC is, well, you know, it's slavery. They enslave their fighters. They don't allow them to fight elsewhere. Well, that is why. They yeah. shouldn't be allowed to fight elsewhere. And one last thing, the co-promotion thing. Look at what happened to Strikeforce when they co-promoted with M1 Global and all the crap that it triggered. Yeah, that is why the UFC doesn't co-promote. They know how to run an MMA company. That's just a fact.
Yep. And speaking of the UFC, let's talk about UFC 133. There's a slick transition there. I know you're all jealous.
Mark, I kind of wanted to comment on the Misha Tate fight.
Go ahead.
I didn't get to talk about it.
Go.
I mean, it wasn't the most spectacular fight. I was definitely expecting Kunin to kind of get the submission. I was very surprised Tate was able to get through that whole second round without getting submitted. His submission defense was really good. Kunin was really looking sharp standing. I think she just kind of underestimated Tate's takedown ability and her sort of ground control, her ground attack, because I guess she thought because she was the bigger gal and the taller gal, she'd probably be okay. But,
yeah, well,
man, great performance by Tate. I definitely gave her the first and third rounds. You know, not the most action-packed rounds, but I'm glad she used her grappling to, you know, finish the fight. She saw an opening and she finished the fight instead of letting it go to – instead of, like, doing five rounds of that and letting it go to a decision. So, you know, great finishing ability. Got to give it to Tate. I mean, she really came through here. She was coming off an injury, and the fight got delayed. I'm really happy for her.
yeah, you know, she beat Marlis Conan in her own game, and you know, the funny thing about Conan is, you know, with the Kaufman fight and then the Liz Carmouche fight, it was like she's losing the fight on the cards until she wins it, which I thought was interesting. And this time, she really, you know, she wasn't doing much better in this fight. So I actually think that the better fighter won. I mean, as much as I like Marlis Conan as a person and as a fighter, I think Maisha Tate really deserved that, deserved the win, deserved the belt. So, all right, let's get on to UFC 133, Rashad Evans versus Tito Ortiz Dos. And Scott and I spent a lot of time talking about Rashad Evans a couple of weeks back. You can listen to that in the Life and Times of Rashad Evans radio show from a few weeks ago right here on the 401 Ground and Pound radio show. But, you know, so what is left to be said here, Scott? You know, what is left to be said with Rashad Evans and Tito Ortiz? How do you see that one breaking down? There was a question sent to me earlier regarding the fact or fiction, and it's, you'll be rooting for Tito Ortiz over Rashad Evans, and I said, yeah, damn right. This is, you know, this has turned into the Rocky Balboa story with Tito Ortiz. So, you know, I'm hoping, the one thing I am hoping for here is that this doesn't turn into three rounds of them laying on one another. You know, just a wrestle fest. I'm hoping this stays somewhat on its feet. And it isn't just a clinch and wrestle fest, but that's my fear, is that's exactly what it's going to turn into. Your thoughts?
It could. You know, honestly, it's funny because the trash talk's kind of heated up between the two of them, because Tito Ortiz, one of his first comments was, you know, well, the first time we fought, I was injured. You know, it was when I had all the entire host of injuries, and we went to a draw, and Tito was, you know, basically like, look, I think I was stronger than you then. I think I'm going to be much stronger than you now, so you're screwed, you know, and, you know, pretty much, and that was it. And, of course, Rashad was like, you know, I hope you really think that way, because I'm already planning on how I'm going to spend my win bonus. So, you know, it is there. The fight's there. You know, I honestly think Rashad's going to probably try to keep this one on his feet. I think he understands, you know, he probably remembers what it was like to wrestle with Tito. You know, at that point, you kind of get into where, you know, Tito is at his strongest on the ground. And I think Rashad probably has some confidence in his hands now that maybe back then he didn't have. You know, I want to say they first fought, it was UFC 73 or something like that. So, I mean, we're talking, you know, eons ago. And so they both, I want to say Rashad's probably progressed more as a fighter than Tito has. And but, you know, Tito's healthy at this point. At least, you know, that's what we're being told. So, you know, I see it going a lot like the first one, where I think Tito is going to probably try to get things to the ground. I think Rashad is probably going to try to keep things standing. I think he's going to try to tee off on Tito. I don't think Rashad can finish Tito. You know, I don't think he's got the power in his hands to do it. I don't think Tito has I don't think he's got a chin that's gonna crumble under Rashad's power. But, you know, it is going to be, you know, a case of who comes in with the best game plan and who can figure out how to, you know, make the other fighter the most uncomfortable. I think if Tito can get Rashad down and he can push him up against the cage and he can, you know, ground and pound him like he is good at, then I think Tito's got a legitimate chance of probably pulling out a decision victory. But if he can't get Rashad down, and, you know, this fight's contested on the feet, unless we happen to see, you know, Tito catch, you know, Rashad, much like he caught, you know, Ryan Bader, and, granted, you know, that was a nice win, but I don't know whether he can do the same thing. I don't think we're going to see Tito come out on top if he can't get this fight to the ground.
You know, the one thing that Tito Ortiz has in this fight over Rashad Evans is he's at least fought, you know, this year. Rashad Evans hasn't fought since May or June of last year, and in between got injured. Tito Ortiz fought in October of 2010, and he fought in July, and he's batting 500 in those two fights. So, you know, my question to Samer is essentially, between ring rust and injuries and the fact that, you know, Tito Ortiz is the fresher fighter, I think Rashad Evans has got an uphill struggle here against Tito Ortiz, given all those factors.
You know, I would have agreed with you until that last statement. I'm totally with you in that the circumstances around the fight make it much more interesting than it would have been. like, you know, had, like, say, a year ago, Rashad Evans, you know, been booked to fight Tito Ortiz, I wouldn't have thought twice about it, really, as to who was going to win. But the long layoff for Rashad, coupled with the fact that Tito is pretty sharp, you know, some fighters like to take their time in between fights, and most of the times they should, but sometimes it really pays off to be, you know, sharp. And we saw John Jones capture the title that way. Shogun was coming off a long layoff. Jones was, you know, had fought like 5 weeks earlier. It was actually a pretty similar scenario. And, you know, he destroyed him. Now, two different fighters, two different circumstances, obviously, but, you know, just making an analogy. In any case, regardless of everything you mentioned, which I think, you know, you're quite right about, I think, you know, it might be a little detrimental to Rashad's confidence and Tito because he's coming off a win in, like, his first in ages, and the fact that he's got momentum behind him. And Rashad, you know, ostensibly he should have momentum as well because he's coming off two wins, except that they took place ages ago that, you know, nobody remembers them anymore. But, you know, so Tito has those things, the intangibles, he has them on his side. He also has the fact that despite their first fight being a draw, you know, had he not gotten a point taken away from him, he probably would have won. Even though, in fairness, if he hadn't grabbed the fence, he would have been taken down and that would have changed things. But, you know, he had the better of Rashad for most of the fight. But Rashad is a different fighter now, and I think the matchup right now, despite everything and all the intangibles being in Tito's favor, the matchup ultimately is pretty difficult for him. You know, I mean, I picked against him against Bader and was made to look like a fool, and I'm sure if he were to beat Rashad, Jeff's brother is going to call again and call me a moron. But, you know, those are consequences I'm willing to suffer, I guess. But I still think Rashad, you know, he's a much better striker. Contrary to Scott, I think he has the power to stop Tito. Tito doesn't have a bad chin by any means, but he's like Brock Lesnar, where he can actually take a punch, except that he doesn't react well at all. If you watch the Chuck Liddell fights, even the Wanderlei Silva fight ages ago, he just runs away, you know, pretty much a la Brock Lesnar. He doesn't get knocked out flat out, but he just doesn't react well to being hit, and Rashad has the better hands. You know, unless Tito's striking is really improved and the Bader thing wasn't just a one-off thing, I think Rashad will probably have his way with him on the feet, but I don't think Rashad is going to keep it on the feet the entire time. I think we're going to see something similar to what he did to Quinton Jackson, where he mixed things up. And, you know, if Rashad was able to rock Quinton Rampage Jackson, which, you know, he's somebody who has one of the best chins I've ever seen in MMA, I'm pretty sure he can do the same to Tito if he were to connect cleanly. I think he's going to mix things up. I think in the Rampage fight, he did a really good job at switching levels, you know, faking with his hands and then coming with a double leg. And I think he can do that to Tito if he's sharp, if he has the cardio, if he's not rusty. As you mentioned, this always plays a factor. But if Rashad is on point, I think the matchup is in his favor because once you get Tito down, he's not really good at getting back up. He gets stuck. You see the Randy Couture fight and that was when Tito was in his prime. I don't think Tito is going to do well once he's put on his back. We saw Matt Hamill do that to him. So, and Tito, you know, for all the talk about his cardio, he tends to tire late. You watch the second Forrest Griffin fight from, you know, like 2 years ago now, or maybe a year and a half. He did nothing in the third round. He barely threw a punch. He just couldn't do anything anymore. So, you know, as the fight goes deeper, I think Rashad is going to grow with confidence, and I think he'll take the decision.
Okay, Jeff, let me ask you. Now, the other marquee fight that was on here was Little Nog versus Rich Franklin. Little Nog's injured. Rich Franklin yanked from the card. So we're stuck with the co-main event of Vitor Belfort versus Sexy Yama. You're in the marketing team of the UFC. Sell this fight to the people. Tell them why they need to. Tell them why this is a legit co-main event. What they should look for.
I mean, Vitor Belfort. Say what you want. He's a former champion. He's a top middleweight, former middleweight contender. And Akiyama is the sexiest man on the planet. So, listen, Akiyama always had, I mean, he usually has fun fights. He's gotten, I think, several fights in the night with the UFC. His fights with Alan Belcher and Chris Leben, he barely got out of the Alan Belcher fight. I mean, that fight with Leben was an awesome fight to me. It was one of the best fights of last year. And Vitor Belfort, dude with heavy hands, and he comes and he swings big and he hits big. I think it does have the makings of an interesting fight. I'm definitely interested in the fight, but more so because I'm curious, like, what Belfort's going to show up, and I think this could be Akiyama's, like, last chance in the UFC, because, I mean, if he loses this, I think he's, what, 1-3 or 1-4? And I think he's
1-4.
He loses this, he's 1-4, and he should probably get cut. So I think there's a lot on the line here. I mean, also Belfort, I think his future in MMA is at stake because his performances tend to be very inconsistent. So I really want to see what happens here, and I think it's an easy fight to market because I think both guys are very marketable because Akiyama always has fun fights. And, you know, Belfort, he's been around a long time. He's fought everybody. So I think it's an easy fight to market. I want to see it, mainly because I want to see what's going to happen and if it's going to be an exciting and on-point Vitor Belfort, or is Akiyama really going to be motivated, and is he going to, you know, fight like his job is on the line and fight like a man with nothing to lose? That's kind of what I want to see.
Scott, the rest of the card, you got Dennis Hallman versus Brian Ebersole, Jorge Rivera versus Constantinos Filippou, Rory McDonald versus Mike Pyle, and then on spikes, Matt Hamill versus Alexander Gustafsson, Chad Mendes versus Ronnie Yahya, which is one of the ones I'm looking forward to. And then on Facebook, you've got Ivan Menjivar and Nick Pace, Johnny Hendricks, Mike Pierce, Mike Brown versus Nam Phan. It's another one I'm looking forward to. And Rafael Natal versus Paul Bradley. Tell the people, which, you know, of the rest of the card, you know, because what's happened with this one, it's been marred by injuries and whatnot, and people looking at it going, it's a meh card. This is the second meh card since Rampage versus Matt Hamill. So what should the people who are not like hardcore MMA fans be looking for? What are the ones that stand out to you?
Actually, a whole bunch of them stand out to me. The Rory McDonald against Mike Pyle, I think, is going to be an excellent fight. Mike Pyle is a veteran, and you know, Rory McDonald is a young up and comer. Rory McDonald is just coming off that win over Nate Diaz, where we basically saw him, you know, hitting Nate Diaz with German suplexes all throughout the fight, and I'm actually thinking that's probably going to be a really, really good scrap, and you know, if that starts out the show, then I mean, there's a really strong chance that could be the fight of the night. Dennis Hallman against Brian Ebersole. Very simple. I mean, Dennis Hallman has 50 pro fights on his record, and this is going to be one of the few times that he fights a guy that's actually more experienced than them. You know, between the two of them, they have over 100 professional fights, and you know, a lot of people don't know Brian Ebersole, but you know, he was he defeated Chris Lytle in his last fight, and he's really just sort of he's a journeyman fighter, a little bit quirky, you know, but he's exciting to watch. Matt Hamill and Alexander Gustafsson, you know, Gustafsson is a rising star, you know, and Matt Hamill's going to be probably the biggest step up in competition that he's got. You know, we last saw Hamill kind of getting handled by Rampage, and probably really saw him maybe hit the peak of his career at that point. I think we've probably figured out, you know, exactly how far Matt Hamill's going to rise in the light heavyweight division, but, you know, him and Gustafsson are going to have an awesome fight. Chad Mendes, he's taking this fight with Ronnie Yahya, and this is really his title shot is kind of hanging in the balance here. He didn't need, you know, he was basically a lock to take on Jose Aldo. Yeah, he was basically a lock to take on Jose Aldo. Jose Aldo was injured and couldn't take the fight, you know, as quickly as Chad Mendes wanted. And, you know, they asked Chad, you know, hey, do you want to, you know, kind of wait until he's healed up? And Chad told him, no, you know, I want to fight. I need to get in there and I need to fight. So he's going up against a very dangerous Ronnie Yahya. And I just think that's going to be an awesome fight. And Johnny Hendricks against Mike Pierce is going to be great. Mike Brown against Nam Phan. There is just a lot of really good fights. And what I think is interesting is probably some, you know, if you don't get the pay-per-view, if you don't buy the event, and you just watch the Facebook and then the Spike TV cards, you're going to see a lot of great fights. And I think that's important that, you know, it's probably going to be one of the few times that, you could afford to not get the pay-per-view, and you're still going to see awesome fights.
Okay, Samer, what do you got going on this week in the Rear Naked Column?
Probably a look back at Fedor against Dan Henderson. You know, as short as the fight was, with a little curry retrospective on both. And no, I won't be calling Dan Henderson the greatest of all time.
Oh, geez, we got 5 minutes left. You going to do that to Jeff?
Yes, because it's ridiculous to claim. It's just ridiculous to claim that when the real greatest of all time handed him his ass inside 2 rounds. It's just ridiculous. But, you know, yeah, I'm sorry. Probably the show is going to run over now that I'm mentioning that. But I had to. I really had to. You know, I've been off for 2 weeks. You're going to cut me some slack.
No, that's fine.
Tim won
that's
the round against Silva, and he was winning the second round until he got caught.
And he wasn't winning the second round.
He wasn't winning the second round at all. He wasn't winning
the
second round. He just won the first round. He wasn't winning
the
second round at all.
Greatest of all time, Samer, got finished by Rio Chonin, who Hendo knocked the frack out. So, I mean,
you know. Who cares about MMA math when the guys actually faced each other and one of them won? Who cares who beat Rio Chonin? You know, Henderson has more losses on his record. So, you know, that's just thought.
Jeff, I have a question for you.
And beat Fedor.
I have a question for you, Jeff.
The same Fedor that you call overrated. So, you know, what do I say to that?
It reinforces that. I listed Dan Henderson over Fedor before this fight happened. So it only
You listed him over Anderson Silva. That's the ridiculous part,
right.
Not the Fedor part.
I have to think about that.
You listed him over
Anderson. In 60 seconds, can you summarize why you think Anderson Silva not greater than Dan Henderson?
Because he danced against Damian Maia.
He hasn't won two titles in two weight classes. He hasn't won two titles in two weight classes.
Didn't compete in the Olympics. The Olympics have nothing to do with MMA. Okay, let me refute that really quickly. He didn't win titles in two weight classes because he's been stuck defending his title in one weight classes because he actually wins fights. You know, Randy Couture, I love him to death, but the reason Randy Couture was able to win multiple titles is because he lost his titles. Had he held on to his heavyweight title for 4 or 5 years like Anderson Silva did, he wouldn't have done what he's done. He wouldn't have moved down to the light heavyweight division. The reason he was able to do that was because he actually lost fights. It's just that Anderson Silva doesn't lose fights. That's the problem. You know, Anderson Silva beat Hayato Sakurai when he was the top welterweight in the world. He beat Rich Franklin when he was the top middleweight. And he beat Forrest Griffin as well at light heavyweight. And, you know, had the UFC allowed him to move up, and he didn't want to, and, you know, who can blame him? But if he'd moved to light heavyweight back in 2008 like he wanted to, he wouldn't have won the title there. You know, is he a victim of his own success? Defending titles is way more important than winning titles because it shows consistency and the ability to win fights, fight in, fight out. Dan Anderson is definitely one of the greatest of all time. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, he lost to Jake Shields at middleweight. That's why he was able to move to light heavyweight and win the title. So, you know, the losses allowed him to be that great.
Bring on John Jones. Dan Henderson is going to knock him down.
All right, I would love to see that. Especially the John Jones thing. I would love to see Dan.
Samer, we agree. I would also love to see it.
Well, you know, I'm just looking at Anderson Silva's record here. You know, I mean, here's my question to Jeff, in all seriousness, because I'd love to make fun of this whole argument. But he hasn't lost a fight since 2006, and in that time, he's fought Rich Franklin twice. Chris Leben, Nate Marquardt, he's beaten Dan Henderson. You know, most of these have been finishes. So my question to Jeff is, if he goes another 5 years and goes undefeated, would you then, because now he's tied with Fedor for the same, you know, or actually if he makes the entire 10, then he's ahead. And you can make the argument that he's faced stiffer competition in his own weight class. So then would you then give it to Anderson Silva if he actually goes 10 years being undefeated?
I mean, listen, I think I ranked Anderson Silva above Fedor. And, you know, if I had wheels and pedals, I'd be a bicycle. You know, if he's fighting this well into his 40s, you know, maybe he can be better than Dan Henderson, and maybe he can become the greatest.
He was better. When they actually fought, he was better. He kicked his ass. There are no ifs about it.
Just
that's the problem. There are really no ifs with Anderson Silva because he's actually proven his greatness.
Samer, you dropped out of the staff roundtables for this week. I predicted that Dan Henderson
would win. I dropped out because I have a life, and I predicted the outcome of the column. What difference does it make anyway if I make the prediction in my column
you
or in the roundtable?
It's only if you're in the roundtable. Like, I made predictions,
right.
Too.
The one that
these
column
are unofficial because I get them on Facebook.
Right, exactly.
Samer,
nobody reads my column anyway.
Likely outcome would be that Fedor...
I predicted that Fedor would submit him in the second round. That was my prediction. I predicted that Fedor would submit him in the second round, and I was wrong.
You didn't make a formal prediction in the
what
staff round.
Who do I need to call to make a formal prediction? Do I need to contact
wrong.
Scott Coker?
You predicted wrong, Samer. You should give me my due. I want
you
my
predicted
due.
Ryan Bader to be Eight. John Jones, Jeff. Really, you really have no right to talk about bad predictions. And, you know, let's not make this childish, but didn't you finish below me last year in the prediction percentages? Yeah, you actually did.
Oh, God.
And
no,
were they
official? Prediction percentages.
What were they, official predictions?
Right, yeah, they were in the staff roundtable, so apparently they were formal. Scott finished first, and I finished second. So, Jeff, really, you are below us, as Chael Sonnen would say. We are your superiors. That's what he called us when he talked about
Michael
Bisping.
That's right. Hey, Jeff,
not
I got a question for you.
No, wait,
Jeff,
I want to hear what Scott says, and then we have to close. So go ahead, Scott.
Jeff, I got a question for you. You've been saying that you just said Fedor was 3-3, and I'm guessing that you're parroting what Chael Sonnen had said, where prior to this fight he said he was 3-2. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what he did.
Yes.
You're getting it from? Because I find it interesting that Chael Sonnen, as a protege of Matt Lindland, is basically saying that Matt Lindland's fight with Fedor Emelianenko is a work, or that it was fake. Because I'm guessing
you know what
that
I also
his
find
wins were probably...
It wasn't
I'm guessing that his wins must be, you know, Arlovsky, Rogers, Tim Sylvia, which means that if he didn't count the Matt Lindland fight, then I'm guessing that was somehow fake or phony, some type of Japanese thing, whatever it is that he calls.
I have something more interesting. Jeff, Dan Henderson's career was a waste because he fought most of it in Pride, and that's where he had most of his success. So I guess his record doesn't count. When he got in the UFC, he got his ass handed to him by Rampage and Anderson Silva.
Dan Henderson is the Undertaker of MMA. Don't we all know that? He's been around forever. He's a legend, but you know, but most of it's just been phony.
And he's now 3-1 in Strikeforce.
Clearly
has a better record than Fedor.
He does, but not better than Anderson Silva. That's what I'm saying. My entire argument is about Anderson Silva. Anderson Silva made his career in the UFC, which, you know, by your own argument, is what really counts, because Pride shouldn't count. I guess, you know, that's what Chael taught you to say. But so if Pride doesn't count, then Dan Henderson's biggest win of his career over Wanderlei Silva doesn't count.
That's because Dan Henderson and Fedor are both rookies, because Henderson's record is only 6-3, and Fedor's is 3-3.
Well, you know, those guys have their best days ahead of them yet. I'm sure they'll improve. <of course.
laughs> I don't know why Samer is upset. Why are you guys so upset? I mean, this should be a happy time.
Okay, Jeff, in the interest of time, let me sum this up. Hang on. In the interest of time, let me sum this up. Because we have a couple of different things here that are being thrown around. And removing the Chael Sonnen bashing Pride stuff out of this, you know, we're talking about a guy, Anderson Silva, who, forget about his wins and losses for a moment, fights outside of, you know, his performance against Damian Maia, fights in such a way that, you know, that he's got a dominating presence in the cage. He's had it since he's walked into the UFC. Prior to the UFC, I couldn't tell you, but almost any fight that he's been in the UFC, the man dominates. He shows what it is to be a mixed martial artist. A lot of his greatest in the world stuff comes out of the fact that the guy's just goddamn talented. So no one's taking that away from Dan Henderson, but this becomes an apples and oranges argument, because you're looking at the body of work that's contemporary with Anderson Silva versus a body of work that comes from Dan Henderson's previous life in Pride. Now, no one's saying that what he's done recently isn't any good. There's certainly been a lot of good there, but much like Fedor, you and your best stuff was years ago. It's kind of hard to say you're currently the greatest of all time.
Worse yet, Dan Henderson wasn't nearly as dominant in Pride as Anderson Silva was in the UFC. In fact, Dan Henderson has gotten like as many gift decisions as Leonard Garcia. You know,
right. He
never beat Murilo Ninjahua. He never beat Murilo Bustamante. Honestly, just look at the guy's decisions.
Twice, Damer. He beat him twice. He knocked him out the first time.
Right. That was the legit win. The other win he didn't deserve. I'm sorry. He didn't beat Murilo Bustamante.
But the point that I was getting at, Jeff, is
beat him time.
There are a lot of guys that show a tremendous amount of ability in the cage, wins and losses aside. When you combine them with their with now going on a 5-year winning streak against top level competition, it's laughable to then turn around and say anybody else, with the possible exception of GSP, is currently the greatest of all time. It's a silly argument, and I think that's why
I agree.
Zamer and Sky keep picking at you for it. It's funny to hear you make the argument. Certainly interesting to hear some of your arguments, but when you come down to it, it's not logical.
And they fought, and Anderson Silva won. That's it. They fought, and Silva won. Like, what more do you need? Seriously, I don't get the argument. He choked him out. Danielson tapped and said, "I can't take any more because I'll go unconscious. Please save me, referee." Like, what more domination do you need? And Silva got up to his feet, made the air guitar thing, danced off, and he won the title. That was it. He retained the title.
Jeff, I'm gonna give you the last word on this, and then we're gonna clear out.
Has been fun. I'm glad to be back. Yeah, go on.
Anderson Silva got submitted by Rio freaking Shonan. All right.
Ages ago.
Guys. Yeah. And you want to know what? The fight with Anderson Silva and Dan Henderson was ages ago, too. That was years ago.
No, it was three years ago. The Rio Shonan fight was 7 years ago. You know, just do the math, Jeff. It's really
Dan
ridiculous
Henderson,
what you're claiming.
Dan Henderson last night, he knocked out Fedor. He knocked out Faye Zhao. He knocked out Babalu. So enough with this, all this gift.
Why isn't Wanderlei Silva then the greatest of all time? Wanderlei Silva beat Dan Henderson.
Wanderlei Silva in America. He beat Vitor Belfort. That wasn't a gift to save.
He beat him in Japan. I'm looking right at it. Pride 12. And by decision. Let's see. Nogueira beat him too by armbar. Twice.
Vander Silva did beat Dan Anderson, but, you know, they stood their meetings
He beat Big Nog. He's one of the greatest of all time. He's a national treasure. And you know what? When Anderson Silva will fight at light heavyweight, and he'll be willing to fight the likes of Leona Machida and actually stop with all this honor nonsense and all this vow nonsense.
Yeah, as soon as he can mimic Dan Henderson's win over Leona Machida.
And Dan Henderson's fighter, and he will fight anyone, friend or not.
And
fight
probably
anyone,
lose
any...
to the best.
We got to go, guys.
Yeah, there's just one thing that I failed to mention is that GSP is also ahead of Dan Henderson on the greatest of all time list, but we're not going there. All right,
okay, I'm not doing this for another hour. We can continue. We can continue this at every show, but not today.
You're
going to
be
having
from expressing
that,
my GSP love. Shame on you, Mark. Shame on you.
You're going to have to save your GSP love for future shows. And I'm sure there's enough.
All right. I'm sure I can bring it on.
I'm sorry, Samer.
Okay. Great.
It's okay. Apology accepted, even though I don't know what you're saying you're sorry for. But, you know, let's wrap this up.
All right. So we will be back next week with a wrap-up of UFC 133 and possibly a preview have you guys seen this? Yeah, the Alexander Houston's actually fighting on pay-per-view again for some promotion I've never heard
Houston
of.
Houston Alexander, you mean?
That's what
Houston
I said, Houston
Alexander.
Yeah.
You said
so
Houston
Alexander's fighting on a pay-per-view a week from this Saturday night. Maybe if we get around to it, we'll preview it. But we also have the next UFC on Versus card with Chris Lytle and Dan Hardy to look at. So we will do all of that next week for Dan Henderson and Zane McCarty and Scott Kachowski. This is Mark Radulich for the 401 Ground and Pound radio show. We will see you again at 11 o'clock next Sunday. Have a great day.